survive a war, you gotta become war.
During the 80s and 90s, one genre ruled the silver screen like a flexing, gun-toting juggernaut, the action movie. These two decades were really the golden era of cinematic carnage, an age when muscles were currency, when one-liners killed, and justice often came with a body count, maybe a bandana. But the action movie wasn't born with biceps and roundhouse kicks. It evolved over time, and at the center of it all were the men, sweaty, stoic, at times shredded men rocking mean 5 o'clock shadows who could speak more with their eyes than many could with a thesaurus that just defined a generation of cinematic mayhem. This was the era of explosions, muscle-bound justice, and enough slow-motion carnage to overstuff a VHS tape. So let's rewind back to the beginning. Before muscles and catchphrases became mandatory, action stars carried a quiet intensity about themselves. Closing out the 70s and heading into the early 80s, the action star was somber, more stoic, more likely to solve a problem with a cold stare rather than a bazooka. During this time, prototypical action heroes were still pretty much carryovers from the tough guys that were forged in Western and war movies for decades. They were still urban warriors, and during this era, action was often more rooted in reality with practical effects and car stunts and tough guy protagonists just drenched in anti-hero tradition. Stars were gruff and intense, intimidating not because of size, but because of presence.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Front and center was Clint Eastwood. With his icy stare and gravel-lined voice, he brought menace without raising his tone or really moving his face much either. And as Dirty Harry in the 70s and into the early 80s, he blurred the lines between cop and vigilante, delivering justice with a .44 Magnum, a disdain for authority, and a grimace so permanent it could have been carved in granite.
It's my car. Now you're going to die.
Then there was Charles Bronson, his face seemingly chiseled by a cranky sculptor. With his Death Wish series, he turned New York into a DIY shooting range, and by the time Death Wish 2 would come around in 1982, Bronson's Paul Kersey had already become a symbol of just cold-blooded retribution. Bronson was basically an entire SWAT team in one beige trench coat, turning cities fueled on urban decay into one-man war zones in pursuit of shooting crime in the face. Now sure, other stars like Burt Reynolds and Steve McQueen were adding their own charm and mustaches to the genre, and Bruce Lee had kicked down the door for martial arts during the 70s, ushering in the early Chuck Norris era, but Eastwood and Bronson, they were sitting high atop Mount Macho, where smiles were rare and neck veins were always being flexed. They weren't cartoonishly large, but they were lethal in silence. With these guys, less was more. They embodied a masculine ideal forged from war movies and westerns. These were men of few words with one expression and usually just one goal: to clean up the streets or inflict justice. The action was great. It was brutal. It was lean. It reflected on societal unease and urban violence. Audiences loved it, but Hollywood, however, was about to hit the gym and the action genre was about to get juiced. Between 1984 and 1985, the action genre didn't just escalate, it exploded like a grenade being tossed in slow motion. If the early 80s were about the grit, the mid-80s said more grenades, more pecs, and less shirts. Action cinema bulked up across the board, and at the forefront stood the protein-powered dynamic duo of Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I'm coming to get you.
I'll be back.
Two titans of testosterone-fueled mayhem and two men who would turn the action hero into weaponized demigods. The mid-80s would be the golden age of high-octane, over-the-top action with larger-than-life action heroes. The Reagan-era ethos of individualism and strength birthed into characters who could just single-handedly dismantle armies while looking like human He-Man figures and audiences they couldn't get enough of it. Sly had popped onto the scene with Rocky in the late 70s and then gained more attention with First Blood in 1982. This was the movie that would introduce the world to the troubled veteran John Rambo, with his survival instincts and his knife skills that made you fear for every tree in the forest. But by the time Rambo First Blood Part 2 would come in 1985, all that thought-provoking trauma had been turned into full-throttle, jacked-up vengeance and missiles on demand. The film made over $300 million worldwide and would easily cement Rambo as the prototype for Reagan-era heroism. And really, he was just getting started, because with movies like Cobra and Tango and Cash and Rocky IV, he would mix cop grit with Cold War posturing. His characters were blunt instruments honed for justice, and audiences really ate it up. Meanwhile, Arnold was redefining the action hero as well, but just as something bigger, literally superhuman. Conan the Barbarian would set the tone, but the Terminator would make him iconic, and then Commando dropped, and we suddenly had a guy just carrying telephone poles on his shoulders and mowing down armies like he's on a caffeine buzz. And let's not forget The Predator, where Arnold sweated, flexed, and fought an alien with dreadlocks and invisibility cloaking.
You're one ugly motherfucker.
And sure, Arnold didn't have as strong of an 80s box office as Stallone did, but he was coming out with more unique films while Stallone was riding the momentum of Rocky and Rambo, both franchises that were just absolute cash cows. Arnold would get his redemption in the 90s, but regardless, the Sly versus Arnold rivalry during the 80s would pull in more than $1.9 billion at the global box office. This rivalry was the action movie version of Coke versus Pepsi, except everybody had bigger guns, the body counts were higher, and all the stars had complete sets of vanity muscles. Because these guys weren't just action stars, they were larger-than-life event stars, and the studios followed the money. They were cranking out titles faster than theaters could keep up, the explosions were getting much bigger, more frequent, the body counts were escalating, pyrotechnics were becoming a line item, and Hollywood had to start ordering squibs by the truckload. By the late 80s, the supersized action star had reached critical mass. Muscles had been currency, jacked up wrestlers in the WWF were global icons, bodybuilding was rising in popularity, and the action genre was no different with stars like Stallone and Arnold and Weathers and Lundgren. Then came a couple films that would completely change the genre's entire DNA: Lethal Weapon in 1987 and Die Hard in 1988. Bruce Willis and Mel Gibson were no bodybuilders, they were everymen. In Die Hard, John McClane got tired, he limped, he bled, and delivered lines like yippee-ki-yay with sardonic flair. He was built like your buddy's older brother who drank Bud Light and won a bar fight or two by accident. The movie would make $140 million globally and would give birth to a new subgenre: Die Hard on a blank. A skyscraper, a bus, a train, it didn't matter, movies lined up to join in on trying to recapture that Die Hard magic. Now, in Lethal Weapon, Martin Riggs was an absolute homicidal emotional roller coaster that could also kill you with a paperclip. He cried, he was socially awkward, he was lonely and contemplating suicide. Riggs could also take one hell of a beating before going into rage mode. He wasn't just crazy, he was heartbreakingly crazy, and audiences ate it up as well. Lethal Weapon would haul in over $120 million at the box office and revolutionize the buddy cop action genre.
Oops.
You ever met anybody you didn't kill?
So the success of Die Hard and Lethal Weapon would certainly open the floodgates for more grounded action stars, tough guys with more humanized, relatable qualities, some with martial arts backgrounds, some good with their hands and elbows, others good with their knees and feet. Some were straight-up brawlers, some were better with pistols, but what they all had in common was charm and niche appeal. Suddenly, Everyman heroes with strong jawlines and bad luck were kicking in doors and redefining what it meant to be tough. So stepping into the 90s, the door was wide open in the action genre and audiences were in for a buffet. Action genre heading into the 1990s would usher in a fresh, hefty serving of diversity and action flavor. You could really have muscles, but if you also had a gimmick or a specific skill set, you had an even better shot, and audiences had a feast of bullet-filled tough guy action flicks to choose from with really any sort of star they wanted. This was also the era when action films were beginning to blend grit with gloss, heavily influenced by Hong Kong's kinetic gunplay and choreographed chaos. Filmmakers like John Woo were redefining action genre aesthetics in the West. When Woo would move to Hollywood with films like Hard Target and Face Off, he would bring balletic shootouts and slow motion dual wielding to the mainstream. While on the screen, stars such as Jackie Chan and Jet Li were rising in popularity as martial arts were once again being reinvigorated in the West because of guys like Van Damme and Seagal, and front and center, Chuck Norris. Jean-Claude Van Damme, with the flexibility of a gymnast and the abs of a statue, became a video store legend. He was a smaller version of Stallone, but with a background in karate and kickboxing and the smile of an Adonis, Bloodsport and Kickboxer became sleeper hits on VHS, and by the time Time Cop would roll around in 1994, earning somewhere in the $100 million range, Van Damme was a household name. Steven Seagal, meanwhile, would bring Aikido, a ponytail, and whispery menace to the genre with his connections. Seagal really was fast-tracked in the genre, starring in his first film, but there's no denying that Seagal's initial run of action flicks were top-notch, with titles like Above the Law and Hard to Kill. Seagal was a box office draw as well, but when Under Siege 2 would hit in 1992, earning over $150 million worldwide, Seagal was able to solidify his spot in the pantheon. The options really were endless during this era. The Stallone vs. Arnold rivalry was still going strong. Seagal and Van Damme were surging at the box office to open the 90s, igniting a little rivalry of their own. Over-the-top action flicks were plentiful, yet these guys really were just the tip of the action iceberg. Wesley Snipes was another that fit into that Van Damme category with the looks and the physique. He preferred to act, so he really only dabbled in the action genre between more other serious roles, yet I think his contributions with movies like Passenger 57, Demolition Man, and Drop Zone are still considered 90s classics. Then there was guys like Dolph Lundgren, who just seemed to come out with a movie every year. He had the action figure look, but wasn't as clunky as Stallone or Arnold between the action sequences. Plus, with his martial arts background, he really could do a variety of roles, from karate-themed movies to sci-fi thrillers to traditional cop thrillers. Lundgren could really do it all in the genre. He was like an IKEA action figure. He was tall, durable, Scandinavian, and versatile. Now, parallel to this rise in theatrical icons was another phenomenon, home entertainment. VHS market in the 80s became an absolute sanctuary for B-tier action flicks and a training ground for new stars. VHS tapes turned every living room into a grindhouse. Video stores became temples lined with shells of exploding helicopters and one-man armies and mysterious tough guys with single-name credits, and the formula was simple. You needed one muscly dude, three or four explosions, one unnecessary hot tub scene, and the result was instant rental gold. Low budgets didn't matter, but what did matter was cover art. Studios and indie distributors realized something very early on, that action movies didn't need a massive budget. They just needed a strong poster, a tough guy, a few explosions, a decent body count, and maybe a gratuitous sex scene here and there, serving as the cinematic cherry on the sundae. which would lead to a flood of direct-to-video titles starring everybody from Michael Dudikoff to Billy Blanks to Cynthia Rothrock. Now, by the mid-90s, cable TV and late-night slots were spiritual homes for B-action, then the DVD would take it a step further. They were cheaper to produce with better quality and a faster turnaround time than that long 10 to 12 months that we were used to during the 80s, and this market would also allow actors to continue pumping out movies as theatrical prospects dimmed when the late 90s approached, but for fans, the action never stopped. It just moved from the big screen to their living rooms. Another reason the action genre thrived during this era was the custom fits. During this time, the action genre really did a good job of tailoring films like a well-worn leather jacket around the strengths of its star. During this time, Stallone was often the all-American muscle. He was playing an ex-military something or a hardened cop or a man with a troubled past. Arnold was always the near-invincible force battling enemies beyond human. Van Damme's films centered around tournaments, revenge, or being a loner with a heart who crosses paths with a focal plot. I mean, really anything that would let him kick and look noble doing it. Then you had Bruce Willis and Gibson bringing streetwise sarcasm and endless grit to grounded characters. Chow Yun-Fat brought his gun violence. Jackie Chan was reinvigorating the martial arts genre during this time with his impressive stunt work that would make furniture look dangerous, while guys like Seagal and Snipes stuck with cop roles in a variety of action stuff plots. Each had a lane, they all drove like maniacs in it, and audiences responded accordingly. By the late 90s, the landscape was changing, CGI was muscling in, superheroes were dusting off their capes and staging a comeback, but the legacy of 80s and 90s action stars will remain legendary. These decades didn't just create stars, they created icons, names etched in stone, and beyond the box office and bullets, these films really did leave a cultural impact that's still felt today. I mean, every time a modern hero mutters a one-liner before taking down a villain or a reboot tries to recapture that one-man army energy, it is a tribute to a time when action movies were sweaty and loud and gloriously over the top and the stars were larger than life, sometimes literally. And that's it for today, guys. That was my look back at the evolution of the 80s and 90s action hero. The 80s and 90s didn't just raise the bar for action, they blew it up. The men who carried those films did it with fists, firepower, and fearlessness. In their world, peace was optional, but vengeance was always personal. Thank you so much for watching, guys. I hope you enjoyed this little video. Be on the lookout for my next one coming real soon. It's right around the corner. I hope to see you guys all back for that one. And until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?